You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Russian officials allegedly offered bounties to Taliban insurgents for attacks on American troops, according to reporting from the New York Times. The White House is denying knowledge, and Russia has denied the claim. We'll talk to a political scientist to learn more about this and what it means for U.S.-Russia relations. Now, HBO Max has made the classic and controversial movie Gone with the Wind available again. The platform had originally made it available to watch without any additional historical context or explanation of its problematic inaccuracies, then they pulled it offline for a while. In bringing the film back, HBO Max added a critical introduction, a short video from film scholar and Turner Classic Movies host Jacqueline Stewart.
The film follows the lead of Mitchell's novel, presenting the antebellum South as a world of grace and beauty without acknowledging the brutalities of the system of chattel slavery upon which this world is based. The film represents enslaved Black people in accordance with long-standing stereotypes as servants notable for their devotion to their white masters or for their ineptitude. And the film's treatment of this world through a lens of nostalgia denies the horrors of slavery as well as its legacies of racial inequality.
Today marks the anniversary of the publication of Margaret Mitchell's novel that inspired Gone with the Wind. It's also the anniversary of Spike Lee's film Do the Right Thing, which was released in theaters on this day in 1989, offering a painful portrayal of Black life in America. Movie critic Reggie Ponder has some recommendations for movies that can help people learn more about the racism and oppression Black people have had to live with in this country. Reggie, welcome back to the show.
Oh, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks so much.
Let's start with a look back at Gone with the Wind. Now, HBO adding this intro video to give context for it. What do you think about that approach?
I like that approach. I think that there's a group of people who want to consume media without context. Then there's the group of people that we call from the cancel culture. And then there's the group of people who want to censor. And that's different from the cancel culture, folks. And then there's a group of people like myself who want to consume with some type of context. So I think that they did a great move here. Obviously, the market rules the day. They wouldn't do it if there weren't people who still want to watch Gone with the Wind. Otherwise, they would have just taken it off of their out of their library and you could find it someplace else. So it still is about the dollars and cents.
So you're saying they did the right thing. Well, let's look at Do the Right Thing, also with an anniversary today, 1989. It's available on a number of platforms out there to stream. Here's a clip about the themes of love and hate in the movie.
Let me tell you the story of right hand, left hand. It's a tale of good and evil. Hate. It was with this hand that Cain iced his brother. Love. These five fingers. They go straight to the soul of man. The right hand, the hand of love. The story of life is this. Static. One hand is always fighting the other hand.
Reggie, before we dig into some of the bigger themes we're looking at, talk about Do the Right Thing and why it might be worth a watch or a rewatch in 2020.
It really is considered one of those quintessential films regarding police brutality. And so when we look at what happens to Radio Raheem in this movie, it is exactly what we're talking about today with a George Floyd. So to go back that far and to watch this movie and the political impact that it didn't have, in fact, because we're still talking about police brutality and specifically being killed with a chokehold. This is a very, very important film in as it relates to this topic.
Well, we zoomed in there, Reggie, on two particular movies, Gone with the Wind and Do the Right Thing. Let's take a step back. Can you talk about the value of seeking out movies that give us useful perspectives on issues of race in the United States?
So it's really interesting. When I was doing this, my daughter came and said to me, "Dad, don't forget to say that these are good movies. These are good." And it's so interesting because I don't think I was going to say that because you're thinking about, well, how can you find movies that people can enjoy and not enjoy, but learn from? But at the same time, all of these movies are really good movies. So a couple of things. One is that There are historical movies that will really tell you about things that happen in history that we don't learn in our school systems. And it doesn't matter at whatever level it is, we just don't learn it. So there's some historical films that are a must-see for you to watch. And then secondly, there are movies about Black life. And a lot of times when there are films about Black people, people assume that that means that the movie is only for Black people, but it's not. It helps to present Black people in a different light, not the criminals and degenerates that you see in many of the films that we talk and on TV and on news. I think that the piece with Gone with the Wind is important because you might walk away from that film saying, oh, slavery wasn't that bad.
And that point of these being good movies, though, Reggie, is, you know, you're not assigning us homework, and it's not going to be a chore to watch them. You're a movie critic. You want us to watch good movies.
Absolutely. But at the same time, some of these movies are hard to watch. I know we'll get through to some of them, but when you talk about a movie like 12 Years a Slave, that's as tough to watch as you might watch as a Holocaust movie. There's some real brutal things there, but it is an important movie for people to watch. So some of it is hard to watch, but we watch a lot of hard stuff, and you learn stuff along the way.
Talking to Reggie Ponder, a.k.a. Reggie the Real Critic, talking about movies that offers good perspectives on race in America, the lives of African Americans. Well, let's go right there. You mentioned 12 Years a Slave. I want to give a listen to this 2013 movie. I think it's streaming on Netflix now. This is from the trailer. We'll hear Chiwetel Ejiofor playing the lead character Solomon Northup, and also a slave owner played by Michael Fassbender, and a Canadian visitor played by Brad Pitt.
And that servant
that don't obey his lord
shall be beaten with many stripes.
That's scripture. The condition of your laborers, it's all wrong.
They're my property.
You say that with pride.
I say it as fact.
Speak!
Man does how he pleases with his property.
You come here.
I say come here!
Days ago, I was with my family in my home. Now you tell me all is lost.
All right, Reggie, 12 Years a Slave. Tell us a little more about it for people who haven't seen it.
So this is it's an Oscar-winning film for Best Picture in 2014. So again, getting back to a good movie. But what it does is it takes this man named Solomon Northup, who was a free man. He gets tricked into going into the South, and then he's forced into slavery. The beauty of this film is that it gets people to root for this free man to be free again, but it doesn't necessarily get people to root for slavery to be abolished. And so what I mean by the beauty of it is that, so people can root for this guy and then still see the horrors of slavery and all that it entails in a way, even if they're not thinking, let's abolish slavery. And I think it's a really smart way to introduce people to that issue and to humanize the people who are going through slavery, even if it is through a freed man.
You've also recommended for us a couple of documentaries. I want to give a listen to one of them related to the issue of incarceration in particular. This is the documentary from 2016 called 13th. Again, this is from the trailer.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. There are exceptions, including criminals.
The loophole was immediately exploited. What you got after that was a rapid transition to a mythology of Black criminality.
And Reggie, I think a lot of times, Civil War, slavery ends, happy ending. This documentary looks into what came next.
It looks into what came next. And if there is a movie that I would want people to watch and people are saying to themselves, I want to learn more, this should be on the top of the list. The 13th really documents this whole prison industrial complex. And as you heard it through the 13th Amendment, it excludes slaves. And so all of a sudden, we have the most slaves. I think we account for 5% of the world's population, and we have 25% of the slaves in the world. I mean, not slaves, people in prison in the world. And what Ava DuVernay does in this film is she directly shows how the for-profit prisons actually is a form of slavery today.
We're talking to movie critic Reggie Ponder about movies that represent the experiences of black people in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Of the movies we've talked about, are others you've seen? What do you remember about the releases? Did you see them when they came out, maybe in a theater? Or are you going back and revisiting some movies? Would you like a recommendation from Reggie about something for you to watch with your kids? Maybe share your suggestions. Ask your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with movie critic Reggie Ponder, looking at movies and films that represent some of the realities of life for black people in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a suggestion to make, or you're looking for a recommendation from Reggie, or you have a question about something you haven't seen, want to see if he thinks it's worth your while, call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's look, Reggie, at one of the more recent ones you recommended to us, Just Mercy, based on the life of civil rights attorney Brian Stevenson. Looks like you can watch it for free at justmercyfilm.com, though do that today. I think that's running out. Here's a taste of the trailer from Just Mercy.
Your life is still meaningful, and I'm going to do everything possible to keep them from taking it.
You don't know what you're into down here in Alabama when you're guilty from the moment you're born.
God.
Mr. McMillan.
We're done here. Mr. McMillan, please.
I was just about to give up when I got a call from a Harvard lawyer looking to start a legal center for inmates on death row. I was in before he even offered me the job.
Tell us, Reggie, a little bit about Just Mercy.
Yeah, so this is the story of Brian Stevenson. If people don't know Brian Stevenson, it actually comes out of the book Just Mercy. And the lead character is played by Michael B. Jordan from Black Panther fame. And the prisoner who he's trying to get off the death row is played by Academy Award winner Jamie Foxx. And it really gives you a look about the work to get people out of death row, but it also gives you a very good look at how people are railroaded into the jail system. Is that this guy was innocent, and there's so many that have been freed by Brian Stevenson. So a very important film to watch. This movie will compel you to go learn more about Brian Stevenson and also about people who have been unjustly convicted in the system, and there are a lot of them. And he was on death row. So a very moving film and an important film. Brian Stevenson is my hero.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ed is with us in Wautoma. Ed, hello.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about a movie that I saw that I think is excellent. It's called The Free State of Jones. It's with McConaughey. What's his first name?
Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, he joined the Civil War to be a medic, and his son got taken and put into the Civil War to fight, and he got killed. So McConaughey got out of the Civil War and started taking slaves and building his own revolt against the Confederates. And I think it's in Alabama, and it's still called The Free State of Jones.
Interesting. Reggie, that's one I haven't seen. I'd read some about it. Is that one you've watched?
Yes, it is, and I think that it actually adds a voice to what happened from a slavery perspective. So I enjoyed it, and I would say, it definitely adds some texture to some of the things that were happening during that time.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to callers, you gave us a lot to work with, Reggie. Highlight a couple more movies. I don't think we're going to get to all of your recommendations, but hit us with a couple more that we should have on our radar.
Yeah, so you mentioned maybe something to watch with the kids. Remember the Titans is a very good way to introduce kids to the issue of racism. It is about a black coach played by Denzel Washington who has to go in and be an assistant coach to a famed white coach, and the racial tensions that happen between him and between the two coaches, but also the racial tensions that happens between the players and the families, and then how sports actually ended up bringing them together. This is a great film to and it's based on a true story. So it's a great film to introduce people to that. I Am Not Your Negro. Anything that has to do with James Baldwin is important. If you don't like movies and you just like reading, you need to read some James Baldwin. So I Am Not Your Negro really talks about this whole issue of why do we need the N-word? Because black people don't need the N-word. That white folks must have needed the N-word for a reason. And he talks about that and how it dehumanizes us as black people. And it's really great to hear somebody like a James Baldwin who left this country to experience the freedoms that he could not experience in this country as a black man. So that would be one. And just speaking about James Baldwin, I'd also say, to watch If Beale Street Could Talk, which is one of his novels that was brought to the big screen.
I want to give a listen to some of that documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, based on that manuscript by James Baldwin.
If any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad so there won't be any more like him.
Talking to Reggie Ponder, a film critic. He is sharing movies about black life in America with us. Let's go back to your calls now. Judith is with us in Dubuque. Judith, hi.
Hi. Hey, Reggie, I just had a question. I've worked with a lot of black musicians, and I'm wondering, is there a film or a documentary that would speak to the way that so many of the black artists' music was appropriated? And they were never paid properly, never got the credit. Is there anything like that that you know of?
Interesting question, Reggie.
Yes, there are, and I cannot remember them off the top of my head. There are at least two that I saw in the last 2 years. What I'll do is I'll make sure to give those to Rob that talk about that. So certainly. And then there's movies about particular artists like Little Richard, who they really look into that for that particular artist as well. But Cadillac Records might be one that comes to mind a little bit that touches on that as well. But I'll make sure to pass some on to Rob on that.
Judith, thanks a lot for the call. I hope that helps, and keep listening. I'll try to pass that along later on the show or at a future show. Let's touch on one or two. Now, Get Out. This was a different kind of movie. Funny, scary, a lot going on in this movie.
A lot going on in this movie. But it really is, it does a couple of things. One, a black guy goes missing, and it's like, why is he going missing? But two, it really touches on slavery in a way about how these blacks were used for servitude in Get Out. They were hypnotized and used to basically help white people prolong their lives. It's a horror movie in an interesting way, because a lot of black folks would say life for us is a horror in a way. So I think Jordan Peele really peels back a lot of layers in this, and excuse the pun.
Yeah, I want to talk about kind of how this all fits into movie history. Now, we talked about Gone with the Wind earlier, you know, some questionable stuff there, a lot of it. It is, when you adjust for inflation, I just double-checked, the top grossing movie of all time, adjusted for inflation. And then
that's right.
This pivotal movie before that, The Birth of a Nation, you know, huge influence on how movies were produced. And, of course, it tells the story with the Confederates basically being the good guys and the Ku Klux Klan being the good guys. It seems like with those pivotal pillars in movie history, there's some catching up to do here still today.
There's a lot of catching up to do, and I'm actually very thrilled that people are asking the question, what should I do? As a film critic, one of the things I can say when people say, well, educate yourself, I can send you to some films to watch, and hopefully that some of the films that that didn't do well at the box office, people are now seeking those films to just get some type of understanding. One of the things that James Baldwin said, and is really, really important, is, and I'm looking for the exact quote, but he basically said something to the effect that if you don't confront the issue, you can't solve it. And so we need to have these real conversations. And I think movies are a safe way to actually have them, because after you watch that movie, you can go back with somebody and discuss what you saw. You can go back and look up some of that information and augment what you saw. So I think movies are a good way to get into that discussion.
In our last minute, Reggie, are you seeing positive trends when it comes to black people being on both sides of the camera in movie production? Are we moving in a better direction there?
Well, the whole issue of Hollywood So White, which was about 3 years ago, is still an issue today. If you remember the Academy Awards just recently, it was, again, all the major actors in front of the camera who were nominated were white men. So there is a lot of work still to be done as it relates to that. You look at something like The Simpsons. The Simpsons, for black characters, had other people voicing black characters. So in terms of work and things of that nature, there's still some issues in Hollywood. Hollywood is one of those last bastions of exclusion, and they have a lot of work to do. Just in my field alone, as a film critic, you don't know a lot of black film critics, because the work for black film critics is not there as well. So I think Hollywood has a lot to do, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'd like to end it by giving that James Baldwin quote, that not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it can be faced. So go face some movies, watch some movies, and enjoy yourself.
Reggie, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Chicago-based movie critic Reggie Ponder. We talked to him today about some of his recommendations for feature films and documentaries that portray some of the oppression and racism that have been part of life for black people in America. Coming up, we'll talk about U.S.-Russia relations in light of the report alleging Russian intelligence agents offered bounties to Taliban fighters for attacks on American troops. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, it's a big election year in Wisconsin and around the country. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of the new book, What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the New York Times this week reported that intelligence officials warned the Trump administration that Russia was offering bounties to Taliban fighters for attacks on American troops in Afghanistan. The Trump administration has denied knowledge of the news and has claimed that the intelligence community hasn't reached consensus on the information. Russia has also denied the allegations. Our next guest joins us to talk about the news and what it could say about current and future diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Russia. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's good to be back.
Well, what is your initial reaction, Lowell, to this story out this week?
Well, I think even Mitch McConnell has said today that if it's true, it's not surprising. And so in some ways, I guess the Russian side of it does not surprise me that the GRU, the Russian military intelligence agency, would be involved in something like providing incentives for U.S. troops in Afghanistan to be targeted and killed. I think the other parts of the story are the things that have been real surprising. And again, I will say everything I'm saying today is assuming that all these accounts are true. And I think we have certainly a lot of reasons to believe at least a lot of the reporting that there were multiple streams of intelligence about this are pretty well backed up. But assuming it's true, again, the idea that the president was not briefed on this, I think, is in fact quite surprising. It certainly is the kind of thing that would rise to the level of concern and warrant some kind of briefing of him.
Right. This is intelligence reports being reported on in the media. So there's some asterisk here. Up to this, though, apart from what is allegedly happening in Afghanistan, what do we know for pretty sure about Russian efforts or Russian intelligence efforts directed against the West?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the Russian intelligence agencies have been involved in a variety of different things, including, you know, things we've talked about in the past about not just involvement in elections, not just the United States, but other countries' elections, the targeting of former Russian officials who are living abroad, the, you know, famous poisoning case in the UK. There's a lot of things like that that this sort of fits into a pattern of, and it's in particular a kind of piece of a pattern case of Afghanistan because of the history of Russian involvement in Afghanistan, specifically as part of the Soviet Union. The USSR invaded Afghanistan in 1979 and had to withdraw in 1989. And so I think that Russia not only cares about Afghanistan as a kind of relative neighbor in that it Afghanistan borders countries that border Russia, but also that history of it involving the USSR, and frankly, if they can play a role in us withdrawing and essentially looking like we have kind of left a mess when we leave, helping create a kind of sign of weakness for our foreign policy, which would then bolster Russia as a kind of regional power in that area.
Yeah, looking at Afghanistan, maybe through Putin's eyes, I mean, he was what, in his 30s or 40s, I think, as the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan, a well-funded effort from the U.S. Helped the forces that ultimately helped push them out. He could see this. I don't want to, you know, go inside his head, but this could be seen as a sort of revenge if he could flip the scales against the United States here.
Sure, and I think that people are correct in talking about Putin as someone who's very strategic and certainly takes advantages of opportunities when presented with them. And I think he's seen a lot of opportunities in the last few years. But at the same time, I think one thing that people miss is he was deeply sort of resentful and angry. There's really good evidence about the different things that were going on in the 1990s, for example, in the early post-Soviet period, where he and friends were sort of getting together to talk about the weaknesses of Russia at that point as a power and how far it had fallen and how much the West was responsible for that. So I think while, you know, it certainly is the case that he is very good at strategy and good at taking advantage of things. I would also not, you know, let people, you know, sort of think that this is not somebody that also cares about these things, that for him, the weakness and certainly the perceived weakness of Russia is always a driving force in a lot of what he tries to do.
We're talking to Lowell Barrington, political scientist at Marquette University, looking at the news reports and allegations of Russian bounties offered to Taliban to target U.S. troops in Afghanistan. That's the Russian side of things. Let's look a little closer to home here and what the president may have known. You were talking about that just a bit ago. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany was asked about this at a briefing. Here's some of what she had to say.
The president is briefed on verified intelligence. And again, I would just point you back to the absolutely irresponsible decision of the New York Times to falsely report that he was briefed on something that he, in fact, was not briefed on. And I really think that it's time for the New York Times to step back and ask themselves why they've been wrong, so often.
Now, other media outlets have confirmed at least some details of this reporting, Lowell. So what questions, and a lot of people in Congress are asking questions, what questions are you hoping get answered about kind of the chain of briefings of the president?
Well, I think, first of all, let me start with what the press secretary said there, which is that very carefully using words about, again, that there was not a consensus on the intelligence or it had not been verified. Even the White House has been very careful to not say what President Trump had said, which is that the evidence is not credible. And there's a reason for that. I mean, there's almost never a unanimous 100% surety of field reports from intelligence agents. You know, you always need to do further corroboration of those reports. But if the information is credible, and again, the key here is kind of a mix of how credible it is and how important it is. So the more important the issue would be, the less you need to wait for kind of more and more and more verification before you would bring it up the chain to top officials. I think in those situations, again, in this case, I mean, we're looking at something where there was, again, multiple intelligence reports. And And again, this is an AP report, and there's some now initial looks like sort of backing up from other media outlets as well, but that in fact the earliest intelligence reports were coming in early 2019 about this, and that they made their way to the National Security Council level. So again, this is not something that we can sort of say there isn't a good case for briefing him on this. If he wasn't briefed again, that's a really puzzling situation for me. I think it's most likely because we seem to have some different reports that, in fact, it had been included in either some brief oral comments from people or at a minimum in the daily briefings, that it may have just been something that, again, if it was in a daily briefing, the president may not have read or did not sort of take seriously.
Democratic Representative Adam Schiff talked to NPR about this morning. He's on the House Intelligence Committee and was planning on meeting with White House staff today. Here's some of what he had to say about the allegations.
At some point, they will either confirm or deny the actual intelligence reports, but until they do, I can't comment on that. I can tell you that I have and continue to have had for some time concerns about Russia's malevolent actions around the world, including in Afghanistan. And one of the questions I have when I go to the White House today is going to be, if this wasn't briefed to the president at a time when he was inviting Russia back into the G8, why wasn't it? And if it was, why on earth would he be welcoming Russia back in the Community of Nations if they're engaged in paying bounties for the killing of U.S. troops?
What are you watching for from Congress on this issue now, Lowell?
Well, I would expect that at least in the House, because we have Democrats controlling those committees, that there will be, I mean, they've already really put in requests apparently from for briefings. I would not be surprised if there were official hearings. I could imagine the first round of those might be behind closed doors, just because, again, if there's some, you know, really serious intelligence information in this that they would not want out in the open, you might have some closed door hearings. I would also expect at some point, though, that there would be open public hearings about this as well, at least again in the House. But again, this is really not been a partisan issue in terms of its response. The normal situation of the last, especially year or two, where Republicans in Congress have kind of fallen behind the president, even when it's not something in their history that they would have kind of backed, in a positive way. I mean, you have all sorts of Republicans in both the House and the Senate saying this needs to be looked into. We need to know when, you know, we did know about it, and if it's true that there need to be really concrete steps taken. So I think that, again, some things maybe even in both houses of Congress will be forthcoming.
We're talking to Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He's with us to talk about U.S.-Russia relations in light of the report that Russian officials were allegedly offering bounties on American troops in Afghanistan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts or questions do you have about U.S.-Russian relations? What do you think about this news report about these alleged bounties? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about allegations that Russia offered bounties to Taliban fighters for attacks on American troops in Afghanistan. Lowell Barrington stays with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, and reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dave is with us in Eagle. Dave, hello.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Dave?
I just got two quick points. The first one is regarding the United States foreign policy. I would say that over the past 60 to 70 years, our foreign policy has been absolutely atrocious. And I think the best way to prevent American soldiers from being targeted and put in other people's countries we've invaded, keeping them out of their crosshairs, is to bring them home and not be meddling in everybody's countries. Second thing,
Dave,
is...
Okay, go ahead, Dave.
I was going to say the second thing is to really realize that Russia is not, as far as I'm concerned, a massive threat. It's more China than anything.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. So first of all, that idea, you know, part of the problem is, Dave says, U.S. troops in places like Afghanistan or maybe Syria or Iraq where they are going to come into conflict with countries like Russia and others.
Well, Dave has a legitimate question that we need in this country to continue to talk about, which is the issue of when we should be involved in conflicts overseas and in what ways might we try to find ways to do that less often. You know, there's a really quick story about when we initially were in Iraq, and there's a story about U.S. troops, and they're with a translator, and there's a person sort of walking along the road, and they come up to him, and the translator asks the person if they had seen any foreign fighters in the area, because this was when the kind of foreign insurgents were coming into Iraq to fight the U.S. And so they asked him if there are any foreign fighters in the area, and he said, besides you. You know, I mean, the U.S. doesn't even sort of think of itself in that way as foreign fighters in those countries, but we are viewed that way. So I think that's a legitimate question, but it's also a really separate question from the issue of if we are in those countries and our troops are targeted in the way that this reporting says they have been, what's the proper response and what would be the proper response of at least informing the president about it? So I would sort of say it's an important and an ongoing question about U.S. foreign policy and its, you know, our decisions to use force abroad. But that's a something we can still sort of separate out from this particular topic. And the point on China, again, I would say, yes, China is a concern, but I would not say it's a concern at the expense of you know, not worrying at all about Russia. Russia has already shown its willingness to involve itself in American politics and American foreign policy. So I would say sort of a yes and there. This would be, yes, we should be considering China as an ongoing issue for us globally, but not forget about Russia either.
Thanks for that call. Go to Brad now in Madison. Brad, hello.
Hi there. I'd like to know what crime it is that Russia has committed, and I'd like to know what the proper process is of enforcing the law. Nobody seems to be talking about this, and I personally think there's a huge breakdown in enforcing war crimes law throughout the world.
Brad, thanks a lot for that call. In international issues like this, Lowell, does anybody agree on a legitimate institution to arbitrate something like this?
Well, there are global institutions, and there is international law, and there are standards about things like war crimes. One of the problems for us is that we have occasionally used those kinds of institutions when it was to our advantage, but we have also, as a country, and this is not something unique to President Trump, this has gone on for a long time, that we refuse to hold ourselves accountable to those institutions if it involves American troops. So I think, again, we have a great example of a question there where, yes, that's a really important long-term issue for global stability, that we really get figured out how to try to find ways to come to agreement about what constitutes things that should be kept in check and then how we try to do that. But again, this is a situation where it's not really a question today about legality of what Russia did, but in fact, from a foreign policy and national security standpoint, and I would also say from a political standpoint, what is going to be done about this if in fact it is the reporting continues to hold up as it seems to be.
Thanks for that call, Lowell. In our just last minute or so, what are you watching for next on this story and U.S.-Russian relations?
Well, I think, again, there's going to need to be more information about when things were reported or not reported within different parts of the administration. And again, a much better story about why it was not brought to the president's attention if it really wasn't. I think that's one piece. I think the other thing is that we're seeing at the same time a kind of renewal of the conversations about concern with the administration and with the president about how he interacts with certain leaders. President Erdogan from Turkey, President Putin from Russia, there's new reporting about different kinds of phone calls and the way that essentially Erdogan, for example, apparently has an open line where he just calls and Trump takes the calls on the golf course and things like that. So there's this side of the story that, again, it's a kind of piece of a narrative about his closeness to different leaders. And I would just say that I think, you know, increasingly, while he still believes he's respected by these leaders abroad, that he understands them, that he's on par or maybe better than them as a negotiator, the evidence is that I think he's wrong on all of those points.
Lowell, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Sure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us today to talk about the report that Russia allegedly paid Taliban fighters in Afghanistan bounties for attacks on American troops and for a look at the future of diplomatic relations with Russia. Over 150,000 Wisconsinites are waiting for their unemployment claims to be processed. And while the state has added hundreds of staff to manage that backlog, many laid-off Wisconsin workers have gone months without any source of income. Bram Sable-Smith reports.
By the time David Ficke was laid off from his welding job in March, hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites had already filed unemployment claims. Ficke did too, hoping the financial assistance would help him survive as the pandemic shut down much of the state's economy.
It's an online process, which is actually pretty easy.
In addition to the initial application, Ficke has to file a new claim each week he's unemployed. But all of his claims are on hold as the state investigates his work history. And when he tried calling the helpline...
Thank you for calling the Wisconsin Unemployment Claimant Assistance Line. We are sorry, but our queues are currently full.
Ficke said he saw the writing on the wall. He'd be waiting a long time for financial help in a first-come, first-served system drowning in a flood of claims. Rather than risk getting evicted, he traded his apartment in Beaver Dam for a stay at the Hotel Chrysler. That's his 2006 town and country minivan. Ficke drove out to Minnesota to be near his daughter, who was staying with his ex-wife. His ex was shocked by his arrangement.
She's like, you're staying in a minivan? I'm like, yeah. I got the seats folded down. I've got, you know, my power converter. I've got a slow cooker. You know, I'm good to go.
His former in-laws insisted he move in with them, too. And that's how he ended up living with his ex-wife, her parents, and her new boyfriend.
It is what it is.
Ficky's not alone in his wait for help. Over 150,000 people in the state have pending unemployment claims. By mid-June, the Department of Workforce Development was still making its way through some pending claims from March, and more than 20,000 new people are filing claims each week. That's left tens of thousands of laid-off workers frustrated and without income.
I've been involved in rehoming 14 families that have become homeless because of this.
Shannon Times Rainwater helps organize a Facebook support group for people dealing with the state's unemployment system. It has nearly 4,000 members. Times Rainwater herself waited over 2 months for her assistance to arrive this Saturday. In that time, she had to make the difficult decision to place her daughter with special needs in a group home when her family could no longer afford caregivers.
It's not favorable, but as her support team, we all agree that her being home right now without her in-home staff, we just can't do it.
She says Governor Tony Evers and DWD Secretary Caleb Frostman have lacked urgency on the unemployment crisis.
16 weeks. People have gone without income and nobody cares.
There are many reasons for the wait. The biggest is the onslaught of over 3.5 million weekly claims since March. DWD's had to bring on over 1,000 new people to staff the phone lines and adjudicate claims one by one. Also, the agency's technology is from the 70s and takes a long time to program. But these issues have been known about for years and state lawmakers never acted to correct them. Instead, a dozen laws passed since 2011 restrict access to unemployment. Secretary Frostman says the newly hired staff are beginning to help his agency process claims faster.
If they're found eligible and have been making their weekly claims, they'll get every dollar they're entitled to, including back pay.
But he knows even back pay will not fix every hardship of living months without income. Wisconsin's not alone in these struggles. Backlogs have been reported in places like Florida, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. Washington called in the National Guard to process claims, and Nevada's unemployment chief resigned after receiving threats from frustrated claimants. David Ficke is back in Wisconsin. He says he understands why it could take the state a few weeks to get their system ready for so many claims.
But when you're out 8, 9, 10, 11, and beyond, you have to be able to do something for the people that help fund your state.
And as he waits, he has no choice but to try to nab work as the pandemic rages on. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes from a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics, including the latest on congressional reaction to news about an alleged Russian program targeting U.S. troops in Afghanistan and what the White House knew about it. It was a long road for women to have their voting rights recognized here in the United States. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. And it's a fine point of grammar, but it still has some people worked up about it, especially online, where people get worked up about things. One space or two after a period. We'll check out a punctuated debate. That and more coming up on Central Time tomorrow, along with a look at the top news stories of the day. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, the head of the state's Economic Development Agency joins the show for a look at the response to COVID-19 and the financial damage it's caused. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then new research shows that Americans are struggling to be happy in 2020. We'll find out why and get some ideas about things we can do to lift our spirits during difficult times. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.